You know you've got a comeback in you. When you take the next step, you're going to make it count. For your career, for your family, for your life. You can earn a degree you're proud of with Purdue Global. Purdue Global is backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected and innovative public universities. This is your chance. This is your opportunity. This is your comeback. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
You don't have to hop a plane to see the world. This month's Free This Week picks on Xfinity brings you around the globe. Experience life at a European resort in the hit comedic drama Seaside Hotel from Walter Presents. Watch romance blossom abroad in a Scottish love scheme from Hallmark Movies Channel. Celebrate Earth Month with planet-saving docuseries like Eco Eye with Duncan Stewart on Magellan TV. And be transported to your happy place with iHeartRadio's Feeling Good playlist. Just say Free This Week into your Xfinity voice remote.
The 2024 NFL Draft, presented by Bud Light, is finally here.
With the first pick in the NFL Draft.
Catch all 7 rounds, 3 days, live from Detroit.
They're looking to get a guy that they believe can change the game.
With NFL Network Draft coverage presented by Verizon and on ABC, ESPN, ESPN Deportes, and streaming on NFL Plus. Visit NFL.com/draft for more information.
This is Amy Brown from Four Things with Amy Brown. Today, healthier is happening at CVS Health in more ways than you've ever seen. It's wellness destinations for seniors, including select locations with Oak Street Health and CVS Pharmacy. It's doctors, nurses, pharmacists, and everyone in between offering quality care and support virtually, in person, and on the phone. It's in-home evaluations through Signify Health and meeting mental health needs through Aetna. And those are just a few of the ways that healthier is happening. To see more, visit cvshealth.com/healthierhappenstogether. CVS Pharmacy, Oak Street Health, CVS Specialty, Signify Health, and Aetna are part of CVS Health. Eligibility and services vary by location and individual.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
You and Me Both is a production of iHeartRadio.
I'm Hillary Clinton, and this is You and Me Both. Over the course of this season of the podcast, we've been looking at the challenges democracy faces right here in our own country. From the relentless assault on voting rights in the states to an ideologically driven Supreme Court whose decisions have dire consequences for our civil rights and freedom. Today, we're taking our exploration of the battle to save democracy abroad, unpacking the motivations behind the brutal, unprovoked invasion of Ukraine by Putin's Russia. The war in Ukraine has captured the world's attention since Russia began its assault on February 24th. I don't know about you, but my heart just breaks watching the Russian military shelling cities, destroying apartment buildings, community centers, religious institutions, homes, lives, everything in their way. And yet my heart also soars while I watch the Ukrainians bravely persevere in the fight against this attack to preserve their country and their freedom. There has been incredible reporting from the front lines that is keeping us informed. But I want to do something a little different today and take advantage of the expertise and insights of two guests I know and admire to talk about how we got here, where this may be heading, what this crisis has to do with us and with our democracy here in the United States as well as elsewhere. Later, I'll be speaking with Mike McFaul, who served as ambassador to Russia when I was Secretary of State. We both had a front row seat to Putin's return to power in 2012, and we both have some interesting stories to share from that time. But first, I'm talking to historian and journalist Anne Applebaum. Anne's been writing about Eastern Europe, the Soviet Union, democracy, and authoritarianism for years. I don't think it's hyperbole to say she's one of the smartest journalists out there, particularly when it comes to what's happening right now. You may have seen or read one of her many books and articles. She's currently a staff writer at The Atlantic. I've often looked to Anne to bring a wide lens and historical context to the current events in Europe and Russia, and I was eager to talk to her about what's happening now. Anne lives mostly in Warsaw, Poland, but she's currently teaching a course on democracy at Johns Hopkins University. So for this conversation, we reached her in Baltimore. Hello, Anne.
Hello, Hillary. How nice to see you.
It is really nice to see you. I have to say, you've been a constant source of information and explanation for me over a number of years, but particularly over the last few years. And I'm delighted that you can take some time to be on this podcast. So welcome.
Thank you. I'm flattered to be asked and very happy to join you.
To get us started, you know, there's been a lot of speculation about Putin's mindset. And I have my own experience as Secretary of State and apparently one of his least favorite people on the planet. And you are an expert on authoritarianism, democracy, Eastern Europe, and so much else. You wrote a really prescient, very smart piece 3 weeks before the invasion in The Atlantic called The Reason Putin Would Risk War. So, Anne, unpack that for us. What do you know about Putin that enabled you to see that when so many other people were happy to put their heads in the sand?
So, first of all, thanks for having me, and thanks for that particular question. There is a relevance to you, which I'll get to in a second. Putin is someone who was very shaped by the events of 1989 and 1991 in the way that all of us were, but he was shaped differently from you and me and many listeners. I was in Eastern Europe in 1989. I watched the Berlin Wall fall. It was a moment of great excitement, feeling of liberation. In 1991, when the Soviet Union came to an end, that felt like a possibility for a new beginning. It was a great moment for Russia. Putin experienced all those events from exactly the opposite point of view. So he saw the Berlin Wall. To him, he saw democracy activists, demonstrators on the street, forced the legitimate government out of power and forced him to make this humiliating retreat. You know, there he was, a member of the imperial police, you know, policing East Germany, which is where he was based at the time. The KGB headquarters in Dresden, they had to burn their papers in the courtyard. They called Moscow for reinforcements. None came, and they understood the empire was over. He's written about that and spoken about it several times, so we know he remembers that. You know, he then retreated back to Russia, where he was part of this, you know, his generation's extraordinary theft of resources, actually. They stole money from the state. They then laundered it in the West. They then brought it back to Russia, and they brought themselves back to power. But he's always harbored this memory of that humiliating defeat. And for him, it was both a defeat of the empire, but it was also the victory of what he sees as a kind of Western virus, you know, an anti-autocratic ideology. The language of democracy, the language of freedom, the language of rights, the language of anti-corruption. These are the things that he thinks are the most dangerous to his form of power. And he fears that it could bring him down exactly the way that it brought down the Soviet Union. You figure in this because in 2011, when there were genuine democracy protests in Moscow, and these were, I stipulate, grassroots demonstrations organized in Russia by Russians, his reaction was, the United States and the CIA and Hillary Clinton have organized these mm-hmm. in order to take me down. So he sees all of that language and all of those movements he perceives as being somehow orchestrated by the United States. It comes from the West. It's being done secretly. He can't believe that it's authentic and real. And his hatred of Ukraine comes from exactly this, because Ukraine is a country that has been trying for three decades to achieve independence, democracy, freedom, and sovereignty, most recently in 2014, when another enormous grassroots democracy movement forced an autocratic president who was breaking the Ukrainian constitution, forced him to flee the country. And that is what he is most afraid of. And so Ukraine, for him, is this representative of a set of ideas that he doesn't like. I mean, there is a historical component as well, and this, you know, this kind of traditional Russian feeling that Ukraine's not a real country and it's just part of us. But it's also what's truly motivating him is that this is the language that's used by the Ukrainian president that we're all hearing him use now is a problem for him personally. This is what he's afraid of Russians hearing and adopting. A successful, prosperous, democratic Ukraine would be such a challenge to his form of government that he can't tolerate it.
How do you think, you know, Putin judged this time? You know, obviously he had an incredibly wonderful experience with 4 years of Trump, who was parroting everything that he wanted to hear. Why now do you think that this has happened?
So it's a good question. It's actually clear from the nature of the attack that this is something he's been thinking about for a long time. He's been planning it for a long time. He's even been planning the propaganda around it for a long time. It was not a spontaneous attack provoked by something Joe Biden said or Zelensky said. I think he chose the moment for a reason. I think there are a few things going on. One is that I think during the Trump administration, Putin believed that he might have a way to get Ukraine back or to weaken Ukraine or to undermine Ukraine, maybe even using the United States. He hoped that Trump would be an accessory to that. And I think Putin hoped that maybe in a second Trump term, that task would be completed. I think he also imagined both that America was more divided and also that America and Europe were more divided than they are. He did not expect the reaction of the alliance. So it's not just the United States. It's the United States plus Europe plus other allies. Actually, Japan has been very supportive as well, who are joining in the sanctions, who are helping with military aid. You know, he has a narrative about the West being degenerate and the West being finished and the West's, you know, term in power being over. And I think he believed his own narrative. And so he thought that this would be a good moment to strike.
I agree with that. I think that, as you say, this is something that he's long been planning, and it was opportunistic. Now, as shocking as it is to see this invasion, I think a lot of people are similarly just totally confused and, frankly, heartbroken about the brutality. Anybody who followed what Putin did in Chechnya or in Syria or even in, you know, the parts of Ukraine that he seized, I think 10,000 people have died since 2014 in ongoing fighting with Russian proxies as well as the Russian military. So what do you think is the best case outcome here?
The best case outcome is that Ukraine wins. And by winning, I mean that the Russian troops are forced out of the country. You're exactly right to point to the behavior of Russian troops in previously occupied territories in the past. What we know about occupied Crimea is that they came in, they arrested anyone who they thought might be a dissident. They expelled people from the country. People were disappeared. People were kidnapped on the street who they thought might be political opponents. As the Russians move into eastern Ukraine, they are behaving like the NKVD, which was the precursor of the KGB, did in Eastern Europe in 1945. I mean, sometimes I have this horrible deja vu because I wrote a book about exactly that period. And they came in, they had lists of people to arrest, they terrorized the population, and they brought in a regime of terror. And my guess is that the Russians will do the same. And this is why I say this, because this is why the Ukrainians are fighting. It's not just about sovereignty. It's also that they know their entire way of life will be destroyed if the Russians come. And for that reason, the only positive outcome that, and I think the one outcome that the United States should be working towards, is that the Russians withdraw. Any remaining yes. Russian presence in those territories is going to be pure hell for the people who live there.
Right. I agree with that completely. Certainly in any communication I've had with anybody in any position to influence our policy, I think that is exactly what we should be aiming for, which means that we need to have even more lethal aid flowing into Ukraine to help support them. Where do you stand on this whole issue, Anne, about direct NATO involvement, particularly direct American involvement in doing more than providing equipment and obviously intelligence and financial support to help the Ukrainians, defend themselves?
So I understand why the White House and NATO are reluctant to have a direct confrontation between NATO troops and Russian troops. You know, I understand where that comes from. I understand that people, it's not just that people are afraid of nuclear war. It's also that, you know, we haven't had a proxy war with Russia since Afghanistan in the 1980s, which was a completely different war, completely different era, not the same stakes in terms of, you know, in terms of nuclear weapons and so on. And people just don't know what the rules are. I mean, what counts as escalation? What's a provocation? You know, I don't think we have the same kinds of back channels. There's no Politburo. There are no intermediate institutions with which we have relationships. It's not clear even that ambassadors, you know, have any influence in this, in the Putin regime. So we don't have any contacts with them. So I understand that reluctance. However, I also worry that some in Washington and elsewhere haven't really understood what the stakes are here. I mean, I don't think we can allow Ukraine to be defeated. I think that it would have such catastrophic consequences for us and for our allies, both in inviting Putin to come into those territories and in terms of what it would mean for the self-confidence of NATO allies, but also other allies around the world. I hope that people in Washington are beginning to be a little bit more creative, that if a no-fly zone is out, then are we thinking about doing big military exercises in the Baltic Sea in order to draw Russian troops away? Are we thinking about ways of training and arming Ukrainians that we haven't tried before?
One of the things that you've done so effectively over the last couple of years, particularly, is to link what the stakes are between this rise of autocracy, particularly the aggressive disinformation campaigns of Russia, but linking it to a rise in either an indifference or contempt or rejection of democracy on the part of too many people, in my view, in Europe and in the United States. Do you think that this could be a turning point in waking people up as to what is at stake and what could be lost if we don't protect our freedom and our democratic institutions?
I think all of the people who took democracy for granted in our society and in allied societies suddenly realize how much they would have to lose and how much value there is in the institutions that we have and why we need to protect them and reinforce them. I mean, it's been actually very interesting to watch how some of the pro-Russian politicians in Europe have been embarrassed. Salvini, who is the leader of the Italian far right, went to the Polish border a few days ago, where the mayor of the local town shouted at him on camera and waved a T-shirt that he'd worn in Moscow, which is a sort of pro-Putin T-shirt, and said, you know, Mr. Salvini, do you want to wear this when you're talking to the refugees? There is a feeling that these pro-Russian politicians who were very often taking money from or at least accepting kind of PR help from the Russians or had interactions with the Russians are part of the problem. They did have influence in a lot of societies. And the feeling that they are partly responsible is now quite widespread. I mean, Nigel Farage in the UK is under attack. You know, Marine Le Pen in France is under attack. So many, many of them are now being seen as having been irresponsible. And of course, these are the same politicians who say they hate liberal democracy and, you know, have autocratic leanings and would destroy institutions if they came to power.
Well, in fact, you're currently at Johns Hopkins University teaching a course appropriately titled Democracy. And I'm just curious, you know, with the Cold War having ended before most, if not all of your students were even born, how do they view this war in Ukraine? What kind of questions do they ask you about, you know, what it all means?
You're right. It's a fascinating moment. I was thinking about how 1989 shaped my worldview. This war, I think, plus January the 6th, is going to shape the worldview of a lot of Americans. These will be the two big events of this era for people who are just coming of age. And I think they do see it, you know, very much the way we've just discussed, as a moment when a democracy is fighting back against an autocracy. Suddenly, issues that seemed very vague or hard to understand become black and white. I think it's also very important that this war kills a kind of myth that we had in the West, which was the myth of inevitability, that somehow liberal democracy is inevitable, that it will always be with us, that it will always win the battles, and that there's nothing in particular that we need to do in order to support it or keep it going. This was particularly damaging in the United States, where it seemed like, you know, we could just let the professional politicians go and do their jobs. None of us had to really participate in anything because our democracy was just fine. I think this, and as I say, and January the 6th are a moment when people see that that's not true, that there may have to be more public participation, that you might have to involve yourself in politics in ways that you didn't expect, just like the Ukrainians are right now.
We're taking a quick break. Stay with us.
You don't have to hop a plane to see the world. This month's Free This Week picks on Xfinity brings you around the globe. Experience life at a European resort in the hit comedic drama Seaside Hotel from Walter Presents. Watch romance blossom abroad in a Scottish love scheme from Hallmark Movies Channel. Celebrate Earth Month with planet-saving docuseries like EcoEye with Duncan Stewart on Magellan TV. And be transported to your happy place with iHeartRadio's Feeling Good playlist. Just say Free This Week into your Xfinity voice remote.
The 2024 NFL Draft, presented by Bud Light, is finally here.
With the first pick in the NFL Draft.
Catch all 7 rounds, 3 days, live from Detroit.
They're looking to get a guy that they believe can change the game.
With NFL Network Draft coverage presented by Verizon and on ABC, ESPN, ESPN Deportes, and streaming on NFL Plus. Visit NFL.com/draft for more information. Brought to you by Visa. Visa. Everywhere you want to be.
This is it. Your moment. This is your time to make your comeback with Purdue Global. When you come back with a Purdue Global degree, you create opportunity for yourself, your family, and your future. It's a degree you can be proud of, a degree that employers will trust and respect. Purdue Global offers working adults like you over 175 flexible degree programs to meet your specific career goals. These include associate, bachelor's, master's, and doctoral degrees and certificates. Purdue Global degree programs range from nursing to business to communication and more. Whatever your interest, we have the degree that will move you forward. You have the knowledge. You have the experience. Now it's time to get credit for the work you've done and earn the recognition you deserve with Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. You know you're worth it. We do too. So don't wait another second to get the degree that will take your career to the next level. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Whether you're a savvy spender maximizing your savings with cashback rewards, a thrifty rate watcher seeking the lowest interest, or a travel enthusiast looking for extraordinary perks, Kemba Financial Credit Union has a Visa to complement your lifestyle and unique needs. Apply today at Kemba.org to unlock a limited-time 2% cash back on purchases. And pay 0% interest on balance transfers for an entire year with a new Visa from Kemba. You deserve a card that works for you. Restrictions apply. Offer ends June 30th, 2024.
I bet you're smart.
Yeah, and you like to hold your own in the group chat.
We can help you drop even more knowledge. My name is Martine Powers.
And I'm Elahe Izadi. We host a daily news podcast called Post Reports.
Every weekday afternoon, Post Reports takes you inside an important and interesting story with the kind of reporting that you can only get from The Washington Post.
You can listen to Post Reports wherever you get your podcasts. Go find it now and hit follow.
You know, Anne, I recently wrote an essay for The Atlantic where your work appears about how Republicans in our country undermine democracy at home, and that helps autocrats like Putin or Xi Jinping. You know, we're seeing this play out in real time. As you point out, in Europe, there has been a shaming of a lot of the political leaders who supported and praised Putin. here in this country, you have followed how we've had our own leaders praising Putin, as they call him, an anti-woke hero and a warrior in the culture wars. And the Russian government even broadcasts Tucker Carlson, who appears on Fox News, because of what he says in support of Putin, or casting doubt on those who are seeing with our own eyes what Putin is doing. How do Russian viewers actually get information? And how do you think Russia views somebody like Tucker Carlson and the other Trump apologists, both in the US and in Europe?
The role of the Trump apologists is truly interesting, because, of course, for me, it evokes the role of left-wing apologists for communism, you know, in the last century. And I think their behavior comes out of something similar. Their dislike of their own country, of the United States, of the nature of modern America, is so strong that they are looking for alternatives anywhere, even if those are autocratic alternatives. And they're willing to overlook the true nature of those autocratic states if that gives them a kind of stick with which they can beat their own country. And so the idea, first of all, that Putin is a Christian, or that he represents some kind of white Christian, anti-woke spirit, I mean, it's absurd on all kinds of levels. Very few Russians are Christians. Almost none of them go to church. Very few of them have ever read the Bible. You know, one of the features of this war has been Russian bombing of cathedrals and churches. You know, but of course, the Russians themselves encourage it. I mean, I don't know exactly where Tucker gets his information, but some of it is quite specific. He's made specific comments about, you know, things that the Ukrainians have done, that somebody is feeding him information about how he should describe the war and giving him ideas. And then, of course, that information is very, very useful for the Putin regime to play that back on Russian television. Tucker Carlson appears quite frequently, and it's, you know, used as evidence that we have support in America. And so he is literally a useful idiot. I mean, he is getting his information from someone with ties to Russia. I don't know who it is, and I don't want to speculate. That information is then being reproduced. It is then useful to the Russian regime. So he's acting as a conduit for Russian propaganda, which is extremely useful to them. It's a really ugly thing to see.
Mm-hmm. You know, I like a lot of people, only knew about President Zelensky from afar. But what we've seen has been truly inspirational. And I think, but for him and his leadership, we might not have the unity and the commitment that we need to keep supporting Ukraine in this fight. Have you ever met him, Anne? And if so, can you give us some idea about how this former comedian and actor has grown into the principal defender of democracy and freedom in the world right now?
The first time I met Zelensky or saw Zelensky was not that long after he was elected. There was a conference, a sort of big event in Kiev. I was invited. He was speaking there. And he, when he spoke, he did a kind of performance. I mean, it's, you know, there was some comedy routine. One of his comedy troops came and pretended to be him. And, you know, then he stood up. You know, it was funny. It was very well done. And afterwards, people said, well, that's, I guess it's nice that the president of Ukraine is amusing. But, you know, this is a country in war with Russia. Maybe we need something more. And people were really worried by that. And they didn't know how he would react in the case of a crisis. One of the really interesting things about him, though, is how he got elected. So he was in a television series that he wrote and produced called Servant of the People, in which he played an ordinary school teacher who accidentally becomes president. And it's a long story, and the plot is complicated. And, you know, and but a lot of what the television series does is it makes fun of how Ukrainians are over-respectful of power. You know, once he's a sort of, you know, an ordinary guy, he becomes president, suddenly people start genuflecting to him, and, you know, he's mystified by that and so on. And I think one of the things that he's understood is that the way to reach people is to be an ordinary person, to have ordinary emotions. And in a country that's used to feeling distance and sort of fear from the state and from power, which they've had for, you know, several hundred years, really, he has broken through, and he, you know, it's what he's wearing. He's wearing a T-shirt, not fatigues. He's not pretending to be a general. He's just an ordinary person who's fighting this war like so many are. He uses the language of ordinary people. He doesn't talk in kind of pompous tones. He uses his own phone to make the videos that he's showing to people. So they're sort of, it's unprofessional. I mean, some of that is orchestrated, but it's orchestrated with a desire to be authentic, and it works because it is authentic. Mm-hmm. And so I think he's trying to inspire people with bravery by acting out bravery himself. This is what bravery looks like. Look, here I am. Here's my chief of staff. Here's the head of the parliament. We're all here. We're in Kiev. We're not going anywhere. You know, we're not leaving the country. That was his first big video, you know, the first or second night of the war. And I think that has been really transformational. I know that people in Ukraine now turn him on every night. You know, he now makes a nightly video, and there's a kind of national, however people are now getting videos, because, you know, whether it's through a Telegram channel or some other app, but people are getting them, watching them, and they're inspirational. I would say only one thing, though, which is that Ukraine has a long history of being a kind of grassroots up country rather than a leadership down country. And I do think that even if anything happened to him, that they would keep fighting. So, mm-hmm. you know, it's what you're watching is this kind of self-organization, you know, this territorial army that people, all kinds of people are now joining who have no experience fighting in the past. That's not just because of him. It's also, you know, he is learning from them as much as they learn from him. So I think they would be fighting even without him.
And what about Russia? I know it's so difficult to get accurate factual information if you're in Russia. And we've seen a lot of protests. We've seen people being arrested. The latest numbers I saw were, you know, in the, you know, 15,000 plus area of people who've been thrown in jail for protesting. I mean, it's ironic that in a time of so much technology about information being conveyed, we're having a harder time getting accurate information into Russia now than we did back in the Cold War, the Soviet times, when we had, you know, Radio Free Europe, we had shortwave, we had lots of other, you know, ways of getting information. How do Russians get accurate information so that they have some sense of what Putin is doing?
So that is an excellent question and a very, very interesting one. I testified in the Senate Foreign Relations Committee and said exactly this, that one of the things we should be thinking about doing now is hiring all of those Russian journalists and television producers who are fleeing Moscow and employing them to create a Russian satellite channel that could reach people a little bit better. The Russians are trying to cut off all access to the outside world, sort of app by app and station by station. All of the Russian journalists have now been expelled from Moscow who had any independent standing. I spoke yesterday, actually, to friend of mine in Moscow who is, she's sort of the last liberal journalist standing, and she says she doesn't want to leave her book collection.
Oh,
which you can understand.
Oh my gosh.
But everyone she knows is gone. Everybody's leaving. And so, you know, I really think it's the task now for our administration and for other European governments to figuring out what we're going to do. Do we need a Russian satellite station, as I discussed? Do we need to be thinking about digital samizdat? Should there be people who are trying to organize communications inside Russia through email chains or through other kinds of connections? What is the best way to reach Russians? I mean, there's a lot of creative thinking going on right now, you know, at the sort of lowest possible levels as people try and figure out exactly this problem. But it's not easy to solve. I mean, one almost wishes for shortwave radios back, because at least there was one channel, you know, on which it was possible to hear things.
Well, in fact, I think I heard the BBC was going to dig out their old shortwave, you know, the radio communications equipment, to see if they could actually get into Russia. Well, Anne, I just have to close by, number one, thanking you, because honestly, you are such a clear and level-headed source of insight and knowledge when it comes to this part of the world. But I also have to ask, as you look at the threats to our future, not just coming from Putin, but sadly, sometimes coming from ourselves, given your understanding and appreciation of history, are you optimistic?
So I am naturally pessimistic. I think anybody who spends their life studying Soviet history has, you know, has some issues. But one of the conclusions I've recently come to, and this is particularly true in our country, is that it's very irresponsible for someone like me to be pessimistic about our country and about the future of democracy. Because really, what happens tomorrow depends on choices that we make today. So nothing is inevitable. Liberal democracy is not inevitable, but also decline is not inevitable. Autocracy is not inevitable. And so I think we owe it, particularly to younger people, to continue to be optimistic. It's only by thinking about a better and more positive future and then figuring out how to get there that we will be able to achieve it. So I remain an optimist. I believe that people are good and that they want to create better societies and that people instinctively understand what's justice and what's injustice. And I do believe that if we try and if we want it to happen, that Ukraine can win and liberal democracy can prevail.
Oh, from your lips, my friend. I cannot thank you enough, Anne Applebaum. And I hope you wouldn't mind if I set up my own channel with you to stay in touch with you, because occasionally yes. I do get a chance to, kibitz with those who are making these literally life and death decisions for Ukrainians, for our future. And I so value your insight, and I look forward to continuing the conversation.
Thank you. It was a real pleasure to speak to you. Thank you so much.
Anne Applebaum's newest book is called Twilight of Democracy: The Seductive Lure of Authoritarianism. I hope you will all pick it up and recommend it to your friends. There's a lot that sadly applies right here in our own country. We'll be right back.
You don't have to hop a plane to see the world. This month's Free This Week picks on Xfinity brings you around the globe. Experience life at a European resort in the hit comedic drama Seaside Hotel from Walter Presents. Watch romance blossom abroad in a Scottish love scheme from Hallmark Movies Channel. Celebrate Earth Month with planet-saving docuseries like EcoEye with Duncan Stewart on Magellan TV. And be transported to your happy place with iHeartRadio's Feeling Good playlist. Just say Free This Week into your Xfinity voice remote.
The 2024 NFL Draft, presented by Bud Light, is finally here.
With the first pick in the NFL Draft.
Catch all 7 rounds, 3 days, live from Detroit.
They're looking to get a guy that they believe can change the game.
With NFL Network draft coverage presented by Verizon and on ABC, ESPN, ESPN Deportes, and streaming on NFL Plus. Visit NFL.com/draft for more information.
This is it, your moment. This is your time to make your comeback with Purdue Global. When you come back with a Purdue Global degree, you create opportunity for yourself, your family, and your future. It's a degree you can be proud of, a degree that employers will trust and respect. Purdue Global offers working adults like you over 175 flexible degree programs to meet your specific career goals. These include associate, bachelor's, master's, and doctoral degrees and certificates. Purdue Global degree programs range from nursing to business to communication and more. Whatever your interest, we have the degree that will move you forward. You have the knowledge. You have the experience. Now it's time to get credit for the work you've done and earn the recognition you deserve with Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. You know you're worth it. We do too. So don't wait another second to get the degree that will take your career to the next level. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cb for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
There's a lot happening these days, but I have just the thing to get you up to speed on what matters without taking too much of your time. The 7 from the Washington Post is a podcast that gives you the 7 most important and interesting stories, and we always try to save room for something fun. You get it all in about 7 minutes or less. I'm Hannah Jewell. I'll get you caught up with the 7 every weekday. So follow the 7 right now.
Now, I know our next guest pretty well, Mike McFaul served as America's ambassador to Russia, starting when I was Secretary of State. Before that, he served on the National Security Council at the White House. He's a professor of international relations at Stanford University and also an international affairs analyst for NBC News. Hello, Mike.
Hey, Sir Strickland. Good to see you.
Oh, well, please call me Hillary, my friend.
All right. Old habits.
I could call you ambassador. You could call me secretary.
No.
We'd sound very official, I think.
Let's not do that.
Well, it is so great to have on this podcast Ambassador Mike McFaul. And to get us started, I want to set the stage for our listeners. Can you describe what our relationship with Russia was like when you and I joined the Obama administration in 2009 and how it has evolved?
Well, first, it's great to see you again. So when we came into the government, everybody needs to remember there was a different president. President Medvedev was the president. Putin was the prime minister. Russia just invaded Georgia in August 2008, and U.S.-Russia relations were at its lowest point ever since the collapse of the Soviet Union. The Bush administration had a pretty tepid response, I think it's fair to say. They did not sanction anybody. They didn't send military assistance. You think about all the things we're debating now, they did not do. And we came in several months later under the banner of the reset, as you know well. But I think it's been misunderstood what the reset was about. The reset was about trying to get some things done that were good for the American people and good for our security interests. And you played a central role in that. Things like the New START Treaty, reducing 30% of the nuclear weapons in the world, new supply routes for our soldiers in Afghanistan, sanctions on Iran, the most comprehensive sanctions ever, multilateral at that time. I'd add one more thing to that early period that I think is important for your listeners to understand, is that while we were doing all that cooperation, we were not checking our values at the door. You personally, and in particular, I want to make sure people understand that. That is to say that when you traveled to Russia, you met with the government and Medvedev and Putin, but then you also met with human rights activists and civil society leaders. When President Obama did that, he did the same. 2009, his first trip there as president, he first day was government, second day civil society. That was our policy, right? Dual track engagement. And by the way, when all that was happening in the Medvedev years, it was no big deal. Obama had a round table with all the chief opposition leaders, so did you, and it was kind of no big deal. It was not news.
It's important to remember we were at least in a position where we were talking with and even negotiating with the then president of Russia. What happened? How did we get from there to here, in your expert opinion?
Two things changed, very consequential. One, Putin decided to run for re-election to become president again. He thought, Medvedev was drinking too much reset Kool-Aid from his point of view. He's getting too soft with us. And then in between the time he announced that he was running, so he announces in September 2011, the elections in March 2012. And in between, there was a parliamentary election. And it was stolen, kind of, falsified 5, 6, 7%, kind of the normal levels, just so you know. I remember sitting in the Situation Room saying, this is no big deal. This is just a normal Russian election under Vladimir Putin. But two things happened. And one of them, you were directly responsible for. One, you issued a statement about those elections not being free and fair. I think you were in Vilnius at the time, if I'm not mistaken.
I was actually at an OSCE meeting. So
that's right.
The Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe. And one of the goals of American diplomacy, literally since post-World War II, was to promote and protect free and fair elections.
Exactly. And I remember it vividly, just so you know, Hillary, because I was at my son's football game in Maryland and trying to find a quiet space to speak to your aide at the time, Jake Sullivan, because I was the guy that cleared that statement for the White House on a Saturday. Mm-hmm. And your statement plus Russians going out onto the streets to protest that falsified election, right? First 500, then 5,000, then hundreds of thousands of people protesting. First time you'd seen that kind of protesting in Russia since 1991, the year the Soviet Union collapsed. And Putin put those two things together and he said, aha, there's a threat to my regime here. And it's Hillary Clinton's fault. It's the West's fault. And I really think, you know, he's paranoid about democracy, right?
Right.
With good reason, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
But that became the drama that leads to the events today, because 2 years after those protests, there were major protests in Ukraine. By the way, I think you're in another meeting in Europe when Yanukovych was supposed to come sign an EU agreement. And he got cold feet at the time. And he's, you know, because Putin put a lot of pressure on him. By that time, I was working in Moscow. And I remember they gave him a big financial aid package to not sign that agreement.
And Yanukovych was at that time the president of Ukraine. So
that's right.
Just for people who may not know, right?
Right. And he was coming to another meeting that you were at, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, I was in Ukraine. I remember I was in Ukraine. And, you know, there was such a sense of hope and optimism, particularly among young Ukrainians. And, you know, their hopes were to move toward Europe. They wanted to be part of the European Union. And that was a separate issue from NATO, that they wanted to be considered Europeans. They're in literally the largest landmass country other than Russia that is in Europe. And they wanted to look west.
Right. Well, and that's exactly what happened. Yanukovych did not sign that accession agreement with the European Unions. And a journalist then turned parliamentarian, his name is Mustafa Naim, got onto Facebook and said, this is outrageous. We are European. He said, come to the streets. And eventually they came to the streets. And that was again for Putin. There it is again. Mass mobilization. He doesn't believe that people can do this on their own. There's got to be the hand of the United States and the CIA. It then got violent, as you remember. By this time, you were no longer Secretary of State, as I recall. But
that's right.
But
I left February 1st, 2013.
Right. So this had happened, you know, after Secretary Kerry was in place. But the mobilization again, that's what they call the revolution of dignity. Yanukovych fled. And Putin decided, okay, here's the hidden hand of the Americans again. And that's when he invaded Ukraine the first time, seized Crimea, supported the separatists. But ever since, he's been trying to undermine that democratic government that took over, ever since, through all kinds of different ways. And as he said the night before he invaded, I watched that speech. It was this rant all over the place. It took 58 minutes for him to make his argument. And by the way, you know, as a professor, let me say, if you need 58 minutes to make your argument, you don't know what your argument is. But there were two seeds of it in there. And to this day, this is what it is about. He said, we're going to destroy the Ukrainian army and we're going to do denazification, which means to kill Mr. Zelensky, to wipe out his government. So this is about him trying to roll back the revolution of dignity from 2014.
Right. Mike, I want to go back a little bit because I know you were born and raised in Montana. How did you become interested in Russia and become a Russian expert?
Wow, we're going way back. I grew up in Montana. I'd never been to California, let alone abroad, until as a 17-year-old kid, I flew to Stanford. I was an undergraduate at Stanford. But I got interested, Hillary, in high school. I was on the high school debate team, and my junior year in Bozeman Senior High, the topic was to improve U.S. trade policy. And so my partner and I ran a case, as they're called in debate, to grant the Soviet Union most favored nation status. That was our case.
Mm-hmm.
By the way, something I later disagreed with, but at the time, that's how I got interested. And when I showed up, you know, it was the fall of 1981, so President Reagan had just been elected. He was talking about, you know, the evil empire, and it felt like a very scary time to me as a young kid. And so fall quarter of my freshman year, I enrolled in two classes that really had a big impact on my life. First year Russian, which I then took, you know, for many years. And then, you know, a course on how nations deal with each other. And I was animated by an idea that, you know, in different ways has been a part of my thinking ever since. You know, I wanted to see the Soviets themselves. You know, I was wondering, well, what is this about the evil empire? And I'm not sure I believe Ronald Reagan. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to get to the Soviet Union. And so, you know, most kids at Stanford, they go to London, Paris, Florence for their junior year abroad. At the end of my sophomore year, I went to Leningrad. I went to Leningrad State University. And you got to remember, like, this is 1983. Imagine that phone call to my mom, know, who thought that California was a communist country, you know, and suddenly her son's going to, you know, the evil empire. But, and, you know, basically ever since that was how I got kind of interested in thinking about the place.
That's really an interesting story because you've been evolving ever since.
Yes.
And you ended up being our ambassador to Russia. And I remember very well the challenges that you and your family faced, because I think, Mike, you also posed a real challenge, a real, in their view, threat to their mentality, starting with Putin, but going on down. You wanted to live your life. Your kids were with you initially. You were engaged in the community. You were on social media. And then we started to get very troubling, you know, messages about how the government of Russia, and that had to start with Putin, was really making life hard for you. Can you talk a little bit about that? Because I think, again, people who are just for the first time maybe tuning in, because Ukraine is so dramatic and so horrific, may not have at all the background that you certainly do about how we ended up where we are.
Yeah. So remember, we left out a few chapters of my history, and I'll go through them quickly. But, you know, my initial time in the Soviet Union, I was like, oh, this place isn't so bad. I went back in 85, understanding Russian better, and I got deeper into the society. And then I came out a militant anti-communist and a militant pro-democrat. And then I lived in the Soviet Union. I was a Fulbright scholar in 1990-91. You know, that's when there was mass mobilization, democratic movement. And I worked with a group that you probably know, the National Democratic Institute.
Sure do.
And it was just a you just got to remember, it was such a euphoric moment.
I remember. Because, you know, the Berlin Wall fell in 1989, and then the years you're describing
2 years later,
led to
yep.
the fall of the Soviet Union
right.
in 91.
So at that period, groups like NDI, and you know, I then opened the office in Moscow in 1992 for NDI.
The National Democratic Institute
right.
funded by the United States government,
yes,
actually.
Yes, and it's affiliated with the Democratic Party, and we were there to help do political party development. But we were not, we were there at the invitation of the government. I think that's the part that people get wrong. They wanted us there. And, you know, I was a rock star. We were these young, idealistic people and got to know, you know, people that later became the opposition to Putin when I showed up 2 decades later. And I tell you that piece because Putin knows that. But fast forward to when I showed up as ambassador. You know, before I had gotten there, these massive protests had been taking place. And Putin went out of his way to criticize you personally. He said that you had sent a signal to those protesters. And so I arrived right in the as that was all happening. And, you know, I remember my last meeting with you before I left. You told me 3 things. You said, be strong. Don't forget about our values. And you were the person that told me to get on Twitter. I don't know if you remember that, but you said, I'm still on Twitter, by the way, and it's an important platform for me. But your argument was, we got to reach out to Russian society. We got to engage with them. So I did that, but the conditions had changed, right? It was one thing to meet the opposition when Medvedev was president. When we traveled together, you probably don't remember, but one of the times we traveled together, like I want to say 2010 or so, I was actually meeting with a group of opposition leaders in the hotel room, and you walked by, and I grabbed your eye, and you came over, and you did a vodka shot with them all. One of them, One of them is a guy named Boris Nemtsov, who 5 years later was assassinated. But you made a huge impression on them, and it was, you know, but it wasn't dangerous then. You know, that was a different era. By the time I showed up as ambassador, Putin was completely, you know, nervous about his regime. So they used me as a target of, you know, to say that I was sent by you and Obama to go orchestrate the revolution. And so that was my fate.
Yeah. No, I mean, his paranoia just seemed to grow and grow. And, you know, there have been a lot of armchair psychologists trying to figure out what's happened to Putin, why Putin is so aggressive and really risk-taking right now. Does he have some health issues, physical, mental? Some people have said he looks puffy, looks like he's taking steroids.
Right.
I mean, do you have any, I don't know about insight, maybe too much to ask for, but any observations about what's going on with him personally?
So a couple of things, and it's speculation, of course, right? But one, remember, even when I was ambassador, we were writing lots of cables back explaining how isolated he was back then. That's 8 years ago, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you came out to see him as Secretary of State, we had to drive out to his compound, right? We didn't meet in the Kremlin. That's because he always met all of his people out in his country estate. And he would sit out there. This is several years ago. Barely meet with his advisors, not meet with many foreigners. It was a major deal that he would meet with you. Very few leaders in the world, even back then, had FaceTime with him. And he's been in power for 22 years, right? So when you get to be in power that long, you don't think that anybody can tell you anything.
That's right.
And COVID added to his isolation. He doesn't get very good information. He just gets this secret information from the KGB guys, and it's all distorted about Ukraine. You know, he's already removed some of his intelligence generals, by
the way. That's exactly right.
Because,
yeah, we've heard that.
Because he got bad information about how the Ukrainians were going to receive them. So I think he's been very isolated for a long time, has been starting to believe his own propaganda, and then, you know, has this other piece that I think is important for people to understand. He thinks of himself as a great, you know, Catherine the Great, Peter the Great, restorer of the Russian Empire, wants to bring the Slavic peoples together, as he explained before he invaded Ukraine, and fundamentally doesn't understand Ukrainians. Like, he just doesn't understand. They aren't just people with an accent, but basically Russians, right? That's what he thinks. And he drastically miscalculated in thinking that this was going to be a cakewalk. And you can see he's gradually getting more and more angry, saying more and more crazy things, talking about the internal, they call it the fifth column, right? The people inside Russia.
Yes. That's an old communist, sort of Leninist, Stalinist term, isn't it?
It is. Exactly. It is. That was scary, especially because I think of, you know, my Russian friends who he's thinking of, and guys like Mr. Navalny, who's, you know, in jail right now, and from jail calling on Russians to protest this horrible war. So he feels like he's getting more and more unhinged. I don't think he's suicidal. So I think we should be, you know, we need to be firm and not, you know, these threats he's making about nuclear weapons. We should make sure that they haven't changed their policy on that. But we should also not overreact to his threats. I think at times, you know, he says, well, if we send these planes, these MiG-29s, he'll escalate. Well, what does that mean? He's going to escalate. Like, I think we need to be a little stronger and more confident.
I agree with that.
So
I agree with that. Yeah, no, I mean, in fact, that's what I wanted to ask you. I think that the Biden administration, and like you, I've talked to some of the people in it. Many of them were in the Obama administration, even the Clinton administration. So
half of them work for you. They're all your former people. Now that I think about it, they all work for you.
Yeah, and they're people that we know and respect. And I thought that the initial phases of their reactions were really very strong. And I was impressed by their willingness to release intelligence in order to undercut what was clearly a plan of Putin's for a false flag operation, right, to make it seem like somehow the Ukrainians were attacking Russians, right, and therefore he had to go in and protect the Russians. So I do think that the accelerated pace of providing lethal weaponry to Ukraine is really important. But what do you think, Mike? Again, it's just you and me kind of, you know, throwing stuff up on the wall, see what will stick. What should the U.S. and NATO be doing in the days and weeks and months ahead? And second part of that, have you been surprised at how strongly the Ukrainians have defended themselves?
Well, let's flip them around. Let's start with the Ukrainians and then what we should do to help them. So it's been amazing, right? I mean, the institute I run out here at Stanford, Hillary, we actually have been training activists in Ukraine starting in 2005. We had our first fellow from there, from Ukraine. We now have 300 alums throughout Ukraine. So people think of me as a Russia guy, but you know, I wrote my first book about Ukraine in 2006. And because of that network, I've been in touch with Ukrainians throughout this entire war. I hosted President Zelensky here at Stanford last September. The only place he spoke publicly, his first Ukrainian president to come to California. So I got to know him. You know, we had a great day together, and he's a very engaging guy, and he's funny, and, you know, but nobody knew how he would respond in this moment, right? He's a new guy to politics, and I just think he's a heroic figure. I spoke to him just 4 or 5 days ago by chance. I was hitting the Skype button to talk to one of our alums who works for him. His name's Sergey, and the screen came on just like we're talking, and there was Zelensky in his bunker. And he said, "Mike, you look just like you looked when I was in California." And I said, "Mr. President, you don't." You know, he's got his scraggly beard and his T-shirt. Yeah. But Hillary, let me tell you honestly, that was not by accident. I was speaking to 200 members of Congress just 4 hours later. And that shows you some of their savvy of their public communication strategy. They mm-hmm. knew that. And they knew 20-minute conversation with Zelensky before I went to join Speaker Pelosi would have an effect on mm-hmm. what I said, and it did. So the battlefield, they're doing heroic work on the battlefield. I also think in terms of public communications, the speech he gave to Congress, brilliant. And that's why, in my view, we should do everything we can do to help them win. And by win, I mean mm-hmm. to fight the Russians to a stalemate so they have to negotiate. And what I would say on the strategy so far, I'd say three of the four things they've done really well, and they have to keep doing it. So strengthening NATO, moving our forces and material to our frontline states, great, A+. Military assistance, historic levels. We've never done something as big. I always wanted more. I think they should have sent those MiG-29s, for instance, and they should have done that quietly, not in the public mm-hmm. back and forth.
Exactly.
But mm-hmm. but generally, that I support that. And the sanctions, mm-hmm. Very impressed with what they've done on sanctions. That's been terrific. But I would say two things. One, the communications inside Russia, we're not doing as well as we need to. We need to get mothers of those soldiers to understand what's going on to Ukraine so that when the next draft date comes up, and it's coming up, I think, April 1st, they say, you know, I don't want to give my kid to this horrible war. And mm-hmm. that's hard. I don't want to trivialize how hard that is because they're closing down that space. But we got to get more creative on that. And as, you know, the professor that I am, when I talk to our colleagues in the government, I say, okay, you got straight A's right now, but that was just the first midterm. We got a ways to go here, folks. And, you know, you put 600 oligarchs on the sanctions list. Well, there's a list of 6,000. And so you got to keep at it. And especially on the weapons and sanctions, it's not sufficient just to hold. You got to keep ratcheting up the pressure on the economy mm-hmm. and keep giving them the weapons to defend themselves.
Oh, I completely agree with that, Mike. Specifically, what more could be and should be done in terms of getting information into Russia? We know, you know, the Kremlin is trying to block any kind of channels, but there's so much. I mean, this is not, you know, 1950. There's lots of ways of getting information in. So specifically, what would you advise, not just the American government, but all the NATO governments, any allied government, and individuals, as well as corporations?
Yes. Well, one thing we should do immediately is to help two in particular. I can be very specific, TV Rain and Echo Moskvy, the radio station. By the way, you were on Echo Moskvy. I remember.
We went to the studio. I remember.
They have your photo on the wall, just so you know, after that.
Oh.
So when I would go there as ambassador, I would walk by it. And that, you know, just to for people who don't know, this is the number one radio multimedia company, started in 1990, this iconic Echo Moskvy. I mean, everybody listens to it, millions of listeners throughout the country. They just were shut down a couple weeks ago. And TV Rain is the last independent TV program. They're reconstituting themselves outside of the country, and we should support them. And they'll figure mm-hmm. out through VPNs and, you know, various ways to how to penetrate their cyber wall. It's not as good as the Chinese. They don't have that in place.
Mm-hmm.
Even more creatively, text messaging is a very important information push. We know that from our elections, right?
Yes.
Opposition knows that inside Russia. We're not doing enough in terms of that kind of messaging. And that's complicated. And, you know, who does it and what messaging? But I think in this moment, that's another place that we want to be present. You know, Arnold Schwarzenegger did this video a few days ago, and, you know, he's very popular in Russia.
That's what I've heard.
You know?
Yes. And the video was really powerful.
You've seen it. Yeah. I just saw it.
I did.
This morning.
I saw it on Twitter.
Yeah. Well, there you go. And by the way, Twitter's blocked, but they're still through VPNs. All those platforms, VKontakte, their Facebook-like platform. I worry about YouTube, by the way. YouTube's a very important platform inside Russia. I predict that'll be the next one that Putin goes after. But back to Arnold, like that, he's an iconic figure in Russia. So for him to do that, pieces of that interview will eventually show up on people's smartphones. And mm-hmm. we got to think of other ways to do kind of, you know, creative things like that. One other thing that's happening, for instance, just to give you a flavor of what Ukrainians and Russian opposition folks are doing, they're saying, go on to restaurant websites, and when you give reviews, start writing "Stop the War."
Ah.
Right. So the little things like that, just you gotta be full in. That's the part I think we need to do more work on.
Well, you pass that on. I'll pass it
okay.
on. We'll see if we can get, you know, more of a reaction.
We'll be back right after this quick break.
You don't have to hop a plane to see the world. This month's Free This Week picks on Xfinity brings you around the globe. Experience life at a European resort in the hit comedic drama Seaside Hotel from Walter Presents. Watch romance blossom abroad in a Scottish love scheme from Hallmark Movies Channel. Celebrate Earth Month with planet-saving docuseries like EcoEye with Duncan Stewart on Magellan TV. And be transported to your happy place with iHeartRadio's Feeling Good playlist. Just say Free This Week into your Xfinity voice remote.
The 2024 NFL Draft, presented by Bud Light, is finally here.
With the first pick in the NFL Draft.
Catch all 7 rounds, 3 days, live from Detroit.
They're looking to get a guy that they believe can change the game.
With NFL Network draft coverage presented by Verizon and on ABC, ESPN, ESPN Deportes, and streaming on NFL Plus. Visit NFL.com/draft for more information. Rocket Mortgage, official partner of the NFL Draft.
This is it, your moment. This is your time to make your comeback with Purdue Global. When you come back with a Purdue Global degree, you create opportunity for yourself, your family, and your future. It's a degree you can be proud of, a degree that employers will trust and respect. Purdue Global offers working adults like you over 175 flexible degree programs to meet your specific career goals. These include associate, bachelor's, master's, and doctoral degrees and certificates. Purdue Global degree programs range from nursing to business to communication and more. Whatever your interest, we have the degree that will move you forward. You have the knowledge. You have the experience. Now it's time to get credit for the work you've done and earn the recognition you deserve with Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. You know you're worth it. We do too. So don't wait another second to get the degree that will take your career to the next level. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
Finding the right news podcast can feel like dating. It seems promising until you start listening.
When you hit play on Post Reports, you'll get fascinating conversations and sometimes a little fun, too. I'm Martine Powers.
And I'm Elahe Azadi. Martine and I are the hosts of Post Reports. The show comes out every weekday from The Washington Post.
You can follow and listen to Post Reports wherever you get your podcasts. It'll be a match, I promise.
Can you really describe for Americans why we have so much at stake in what's going on in Ukraine? Assuming that Ukraine continues this heroic resistance, we're facing, you know, weeks, maybe months of attacks and stalemates and everything that goes with it, continuing threats from Putin. Why should Americans keep caring? Why should they be willing to sacrifice, whether it's increasing gas prices or other economic blowback from these very comprehensive sanctions?
Yeah, great question and a hard one to answer, but let me frame it the way I think about it. This is a fight between autocrats and Democrats. It is a fight of ideas, as we were talking about before. Putin was never really threatened by NATO expansion. He was threatened by democratic expansion.
Exactly.
And he always got, it was always democratic expansion led to him complaining about NATO. So this is a fight about that. And let me just paint two scenarios. If Zelensky wins and there's a stalemate and Putin is repelled, that has lots of important positive consequences for American national security interests, right? First of all, our NATO allies will be less nervous than they are today because he'll be pushed back. Our allies and friends in Asia will feel more secure. Xi Jinping better think twice about invading Taiwan, looking at what a fiasco, what he thought was the third most powerful army in the world, one that he cooperates with, one that they have a lot of weapon systems together, right? And now look at how poorly mm-hmm. they're performing in Ukraine. And if they lose there, that's good for deterring China from invading Taiwan. And by the way, if the sanctions help to keep the pressure on the economy, Xi Jinping better think twice about invading and facing those sanctions. That's a good mm-hmm. thing. But the opposite is also true. If Putin wins and those fighting for democracy lose inside Ukraine, that has negative consequences all around the world as well. Our NATO allies will need more reassurance, and that means more military spending from us to help make sure that Putin doesn't attack them. Our allies in the Middle East will be nervous and start hedging their bets. You know, maybe we need to work with the Russians because we can't, these Americans are not so reliable. I'm thinking of Israel first and foremost. And out in Asia, the same thing. Those are fence sitters will think, well, maybe we better lean more towards the Chinese because the Americans didn't prevail. So I think the consequences actually are much bigger than just in Ukraine. Winning has a very positive consequence in terms of how other people will deal with us in the future.
Well, that's very well said, and I agree completely. And the only additional point I would make is that I think it's also good for our own democracy here at home, because the apologists and, frankly, shall we say, fellow travelers of a nationalistic, even violent opposition, as we saw on January 6th in our own country, will have to think twice.
Yes.
Their base will be rattled. And those who promote undermining our institutions, ignoring the rule of law, trying to undermine our elections, everything that we know, unfortunately, is part of the agenda of the opposition in America. I think that, too, will
Great
be
point.
Shaken.
Absolutely. I mean, don't forget, I don't need to tell you, but maybe your listeners have forgotten, Putin's been trying to undermine democracy for a long, long time, including our own democracy, including undermining you personally during our elections for a reason. I mean, you know, small D democratic ideas, small L liberal ideas are a threat to him. And leaders around the world, including you, that support those are threats to him. And for years, he's been cultivating ties with, I call it the illiberal international, right? Populist, nationalist leaders, you know, Orban in Hungary, Salvini in Italy, Le Pen in France, Farage in the UK, and Mr. Trump and his, you know, the people around him, the Steve Bannons of the world. They have been, he's been making progress. I think the good news out of this horrible crisis is it's, like you just said, it's a lot harder to play those games and line up with Putin. But that's all the more important. If he wins victorious, all those kind of groups will now, you know, start sprouting again and say, well, he's evil, but, you know, he's a strong leader. We can't let them go back to that. That's why Putin has to lose in Ukraine.
And I guess the final thing I would ask you, Mike, is does Putin and his regime survive this, win or lose?
So, you know, I'm a political scientist, and I would say we're not very good at predicting the future. I also worked 5 years in the government. I'd say the CIA is not very good at it either. They didn't get the Green Revolution in Iran right, or the Arab Spring right, or the Russian protests or Ukraine. But with that humble caveat, let me say two things I know I'm very certain of. One, I'm absolutely sure that the Ukrainians eventually will win. I don't know when they're going to win, but Putin doesn't have the army to occupy this country, the largest country in Europe, 40 million people. Stalin had millions in the Red Army when he put his puppet regimes in place after 45. Putin does not have that capability, and he doesn't have the ideas. Stalin was repelling real fascists, and when he liberated countries, he said he could make the argument we're building a new society communist, and he attracted just enough lackeys to help him build those places. Putin doesn't have that. So Ukrainians will fight door by door with guns, acts of nonviolent civic resistance. There's no doubt in my mind that eventually, though, they will repel Putin's soldiers. I just don't know when that should be. We should hasten that. But you asked a different question. You asked about Russia. And here's the way I think about it. It reminds me of the Brezhnev era. You know, Brezhnev was in power for almost 20 years, one of the longest serving general secretaries. In the early phases, you know, he did okay in the 60s. And then the 70s came along and he went on this run of victories where communist regimes were taking over the world, right? So Vietnam, Cambodia, Laos, and then Angola and Mozambique in Africa, Nicaragua, even in our hemisphere, that was 79. And so he had like five wins. And by the way, Hillary, we kind of looked like we did recently, right? We were divided amongst ourselves, lots of, you know, civil rights movement, anti-war movement, Nixon. These were times where we didn't look like we were so strong ourselves, right? So there's a lot of parallels. And then Brezhnev overreached. He invaded Afghanistan and he thought it was going to be a cakewalk, you know, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan. We're just going to add one more stand to, they called it the 16th Republic. And we all know how that ended. It was a disaster for the Soviet Union. And it was one, not the only factor, but it was one of the factors that was the beginning of the end of the Soviet Union. It took a decade, but it helped unravel things. And I think this is the beginning of the end of Putinism. Even if Putin survives in power, which he may very well do, it's a pretty horrific dictatorship, but he's lost the elites, Hillary. I got to tell you, like, I'm in touch with Russians all the time, including people that were kind of pro-Putin, right? He violated the contract, which was, I'll be your dictator in return for a stable economy. Well, that's over now. And I just think it will eventually, you know, maybe it'll take one more leader that won't have the authority, but I do think this is the beginning of the end. I just don't know how long that process will be, but it's very hard for me to imagine a Putin-like figure in power in Russia 20 years from now. I think that's really unlikely. So that's, a sliver of good news. We just don't know when that good news gets delivered.
Yeah, no, and we just have to keep our nerve and be patient.
Yes.
And be smart about, you know, the strategies
the
we
course.
Employ and absolutely stay the course. Well, I can't tell you what a delight it is for me to have this time to talk with you, Mike. And I really look to you for, you know, interpretation and guidance about how we can stay the course. And thank you so much for, you know, sharing this time with me and our listeners.
I really enjoyed it, Hillary. Let's do it again sometime.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Mike McFaul's most recent book is From Cold War to Hot Peace, An American Ambassador in Putin's Russia. You can also follow him, like I do, on Twitter, at McFaul. Recent events have proven what we know to be true, that we are all connected, that what happens abroad matters here at home, and that an attack on democracy anywhere is a threat to democracy everywhere. So as we stand with the people of Ukraine in the difficult weeks and probably months ahead, it's also important that we stand with one another and stand up for our democracy right here at home. Before I go, as a reminder, I'll be answering your questions on a future episode of You and Me Both with a special guest. Maybe you've got more questions about what's going on with Ukraine and Russia, or what's happening with attacks on our democracy right here in America. Or maybe there's something more personal or lighthearted that you want to ask me. No matter what your questions might be, write to youandmebothpod@gmail.com. Or you can leave a voice message at 202-780-7515. And who knows, I might just answer your question on the show. You and Me Both is brought to you by iHeartRadio. We're produced by Julie Subrin, Kathleen Russo, and Rob Russo, with help from Huma Abedin, Oscar Flores, Lindsay Hoffman, Brianna Johnson, Nick Merrill, Laura Olin, Lona Valmoro, and Benita Zaman. Our engineer is Zach McNeese, and original music is by Forrest Gray. If you like You and Me Both, please tell someone else about it. And if you're not already a subscriber, what are you waiting for? You can subscribe to You and Me Both on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening. Take care of yourself and each other, and we'll be back next week.
You don't have to hop a plane to see the world. This month's Free This Week picks on Xfinity brings you around the globe. Experience life at a European resort in the hit comedic drama Seaside Hotel from Walter Presents. Watch romance blossom abroad in a Scottish love scheme from Hallmark Movies Channel. Celebrate Earth Month with planet-saving docuseries like EcoEye with Duncan Stewart on Magellan TV. And be transported to your happy place with iHeartRadio's Feeling Good playlist. Just say Free This Week into your Xfinity voice remote.
The 2024 NFL Draft, presented by Bud Light, is finally here.
With the first pick in the NFL Draft.
Catch all 7 rounds, 3 days, live from Detroit.
They're looking to get a guy that they believe can change the game.
With NFL Network Draft coverage presented by Verizon and on ABC, ESPN, ESPN Deportes, and streaming on NFL Plus. Visit NFL.com/draft. For more information, Rocket Mortgage, official partner of the NFL Draft.
Hey, everyone. This is Jody Sweetin from the podcast How Rude, Tanneritos. I've been needing a quick getaway with my family, and the 2024 Hyundai Santa Fe is the perfect vehicle to take us there. It has standard third row seating, so I'm able to pack my entire family, plus pets in the car, while also having enough room for our camping essentials. Available H-Track all-wheel drive will get us through any dirt trails, and available dual wireless charging pads will ensure we never have to worry about getting stuck with a dead phone in the middle of nowhere. Visit HyundaiUSA.com. or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, There's joy in every journey.
Whether you're a savvy spender maximizing your savings with cashback rewards, a thrifty rate watcher seeking the lowest interest, or a travel enthusiast looking for extraordinary perks, Kemba Financial Credit Union has a Visa to complement your lifestyle and unique needs. Apply today at Kemba.org to unlock a limited-time 2% cash back on purchases. And pay 0% interest on balance transfers for an entire year with a new Visa from Kemba. You deserve a card that works for you. Restrictions apply. Offer ends June 30th, 2024.
With dozens of streaming services, box office films, and content to choose from, people are spending over 2.5 years of their lives searching for what to watch. But The Hollywood Reporter brings you THR Charts, one place for you, your family, and friends to find the most watched TV shows and movies every week. THR Charts is a guide to help you spend less time scrolling through platforms so that you can spend more time watching and binging the content everyone is talking about, all supported by data and trusted sources like Nielsen, Comscore, and Paired Analytics. Check out THR Charts on HollywoodReporter.com.